Well, hello there.
Sorry. Looking for the glasses case that Mark left behind.
Yeah, wasn't here, though.
No.
No.
Nice try, though.
Hey, so my name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
What do you have for us, Bill?
Well, we got a sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located up at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. And they can take care of pretty much any of your John Deere needs, whether it be small ag, big ag, turf, you name it, they can handle it. If they can't get it for you, one of their many stores can. So go up and talk to them or give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Ta-da!
There we go.
Nice.
So, what's going on with the show today?
Well, we have two guests today. We don't always have two guests.
No.
It's kind of a fun switch up. Two guests we've never... But you know what? I think I'm lying. I was going to say two guests we've never spoken with, but I think we have spoken with Lawrence Mead. He's in the second hour. His name was familiar, but I never went back and looked. We'll have to ask him. He'll be like, I remember you guys.
Yeah, you chuckleheads.
But Dr. Lee Gross is new to us. He's the president of Docs for Patient Care Foundation and the owner of Epiphany Health. So he has written an article. I think we're supposed to call it a piece.
Yes.
They always call it. It's not an article. They don't write articles anymore. They write pieces.
Yes.
The public option is the wrong approach to healthcare reform. Yes. And that sort of, I mean, he wrote more than that, but I think at that point I was a fan.
Yeah, you're hooked.
Yeah. So our friend, Stephen.
Not a big public option fan, I take it.
No. What could go wrong? Okay.
Well, I just think the government, taking care of our health care is a great idea.
I mean, when you look, the more involved they get, the better they
absolutely,
do.
Absolutely, yeah. Get their hands
in all they can. I think
everybody
finds that. The more the government gets involved in their life, the easier it becomes.
Absolutely.
More streamlined, too.
And cheaper.
Yeah. Okay, so now we've identified the pitfalls. But I should give credit. Our two guests come to us from the Manfredi Strategy Group, our friend Stephen Manfredi back there in Virginia.
Yeah.
He fires me off an email. Hey, want to interview so-and-so? It's like, yep, because we always learn interesting things. So, Dr. Gross, are you in there?
I am.
Nice.
Oh.
How are you?
Well, great. We're glad to have you today. This is a topic I think everybody needs to learn a little bit more about.
Yeah, anybody who's still deluded about the public option, you're going to help them with that, right?
What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, exactly. Nothing. The government is so awesome at doing everything.
Yeah, because we all got to keep our doctor and have cheaper health care now. So,
who wouldn't like that?
Absolutely.
So where would you like to take the train off the tracks?
Oh my goodness, we can start with your introduction about the government making things cheaper, more efficient.
Epic fail.
I think we're seeing right now in terms of. You know, when you let your government make healthcare decisions for you, how that works out for the general public. You know, when the government wants to take a one-size-fits-all approach to healthcare, and you don't happen to fit into that one size they want to put you into, it doesn't work out too well for the individual patients, and certainly doesn't work out for the individual doctors, that, again, don't want to sort of fall in line with you know, whatever it is that the government interests are in that particular
I remember
so
when
all unfolding in front of us.
Yeah, I remember when Obamacare took effect. I mean, there were doctors all over town that actually put signs on their counters, we don't accept certain health care plans. And I think this is why.
Absolutely. You know, so what Obamacare did was it just increased the complexity, it increased the cost of everything, and it made it so difficult for physician practices to comply that it just drove them out of private practice and into the larger consolidation by the hospitals and healthcare corporations. In essence, it basically just decreased choice and increased the cost. And then the government went around and either did one of two things. They either put people into Medicaid, which squeezed the truly needy out of the market because you couldn't access the doctors because there weren't enough doctors now, or put them into an insurance product that had, you know, an $8,000 deductible, which basically means you had a card, but you couldn't use it anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the whole Medicare or Medicaid thing, a lot of doctors don't take that because they just don't pay enough to, you know, cover their costs, basically.
Tremendous bureaucracy, and absolutely right. There's, you know, just so many hoops and headaches to jump through. And then the amount of paperwork and regulatory work and risks for audits and running afoul of the very complex rules, and then you factor in that complexity with, you know, a tremendously low physician fee schedule, makes it very difficult to keep your lights on.
Well, mm-hmm. And then they decide what you can prescribe for people. They get in the middle of that. So if you can get the people through the door, you can bill it in a way that lets you operate. Then when you try to treat them, the government still is deciding whether or not, you know, your medical school.
They're the real doctors.
Yeah.
Sure. So I'm a family doctor in Southwest Florida. Okay. And I've been in practice now for about 20 years. So I've seen this pendulum swinging back and forth over the course of my career and through my years prior to medical school. And I am now in a practice where I don't accept any insurance whatsoever. I don't accept Medicaid. I'm opted out of Medicare, and I have patients that come to my practice from all over the state of Florida. So I have patients that drive 3-4 hours away, and I'll sort of share our practice model with you. But, you know, for the first 10 years of my practice, I ran in a traditional fee-for-service practice where I was contracted with all the insurances. I accepted Medicaid. I was in the Medicare system, and I would constantly have to fly up to Washington and beg for my life, as the Washington brinksmanship nearly put me out of business. Mm. You know, so when you're getting into these debates over debt ceilings and funding of the government, keep in mind that these physicians and these medical practices are funded by this money. And so when the brinksmanship takes it to the point where they're saying, okay, we're going to stop payment, we're going to close the government, that means that medical practices no longer receive payment. That means that, you know, physicians are taking out personal loans to make payroll to their staff.
Yeah.
And what we realized in that first 10 years of my practice is the government was a very unreliable partner in business. The politics behind absolutely everything made it so it was almost impossible for us to plan for our budgets. We had no idea how much money we were going to get paid, when we were going to get paid. And so one day we had a small business owner that came up to my practice and he said, you know what, my insurance premiums keep skyrocketing. All my employees see you as their doctor. Why don't I just contract with you directly? Because I see what I pay the insurance companies, and I see what they pay you, and somebody here is getting screwed.
Yeah.
And so we had an epiphany. That's the name of my practice, is Epiphany Health. The epiphany is, why are we using insurance to pay for primary care? Why are we inserting so many obstacles and barriers and filing an insurance claim for absolutely every single transaction that happens between a doctor and patient? And then we're upset that it's impersonal, that it's very expensive and cumbersome. So we created a subscription-based practice, just like Netflix. This was 10 years ago. We charge less than the cost of a cell phone for as low as $65 a month for an adult and as low as $10 a month for a child. We provide unlimited services in our offices with no copays, no deductibles, unlimited technology visits, unlimited procedures, and in-office testing.
Right.
And so that has drawn patients without insurance and with bad insurance and with government insurance and with Medicaid from all over the state of Florida to get care in our practice because they can afford that.
Right, right. Yeah, and you look at what the insurance premiums are for most folks, and it's a heck of a lot more than $65 a month. So I could see where that would be a real cost savings. Now, the plan you're talking about now is for just general health care. You would still need to have insurance if you wanted any kind of major coverage. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, let insurance be insurance again. Let it be a hedge against an unexpected loss, not a fully funded prepaid health plan. And so what we find is that even things that you don't predict are actually more affordable if you pay cash for them than if you use insurance. So what we found is that our patients with insurance that had high deductibles or our uninsured patients needed affordable access to imaging services, laboratory services. And so what we did was we contracted with these labs. And we just bought everything wholesale. We said, you know, if our patients agree to pay you cash at the time of service, what can you sell us these services for? And almost every single situation, the cash price was cheaper than the responsibility using insurance. So if I pull out my insurance card, my cost out of pocket for an MRI is $500, but the cash price is $220.
Yeah.
So what are we insuring if the insurance, if using that insurance doubles your out-of-pocket cost?
Right.
And so what we found is that even surgeries can be less expensive paying cash than using insurance. So what we find there are things that are unaffordable, are actually quite affordable once you take the insurance out of the equation. So the insurance truly does become for, you know, the major medical, the cancers, the heart attacks, the bypass surgeries.
Right. Right. Yeah. And, you know, you look at, I mean, speaking for myself, you take older folks, maybe they have some, you know, pre-existing conditions. For a couple, you're going to pay $800-$900 a month for an insurance policy with a pretty stiff deductible. And the plan you're talking about, you could save, well, and then also if you do have to buy like a major medical plan, that's a lot cheaper than a plan that's going to cover, you know, runny noses and everything else. I mean, just your major medical isn't, I mean, it's still expensive, but it's not near as much as a plan that covers everything. So I can see where your plan would save people a considerable amount of money.
It absolutely does. And so what we did here in Florida is we were approached by a rural hospital in the second poorest county in the state of Florida. So this is not a wealthy community. It's a relatively underserved community. And they wanted to restructure their employee health plan. And they wanted to allow all of their employees that wanted to sign up for our program to do so at no cost. So the hospital agreed for their employees to sign up to our practice, and the hospital would pay them back for it. We're now 3 years into that. In the first year, we saved the hospital $1.2 million in their health plan costs,
wow,
which was a 54% reduction in the entire health plan costs. And in doing so, we eliminated the deductibles for these patients. So it cost them nothing to access the doctor.
Wow.
And then we restructured their plan in such a way that if they had anything done at the hospital itself, it was free to the employee. So if they had an MRI, it cost them nothing. If they had surgery, it cost them nothing. And as far as the regulations on our practice, the hospital made it very easy for us to practice, and they basically said, look, we trust you. You are a physician. You are the highest trained person in this entire chain of this health plan. So why would we hire somebody else that has less training to oversee and double check your work? We trust you. So that means if I order an MRI, it's covered. If I make a referral, it's covered. If I recommend a medication, it's covered. They trust us. So there's no reason for our practice to spend all this time fighting the bureaucracy to get things approved, to get things covered. It simply was done. And in doing so, by opening up and eliminating barriers, eliminating regulatory barriers, eliminating financial barriers, you would think that it would have opened up everything to access and people would have flooded the system with demand and it would have bankrupted them. But in the process, it did the exact opposite. It saved the plan 54% in the first year. And year number two, it did better than year number one. And year number three, we're doing better than year number two.
Wow. So why do you think it's taken so long to switch the thinking of people? And well, you got the big insurance guys that are selling insurance naturally, but why haven't more people caught on to this?
So they have, and they are. When we started this over 10 years ago, there were about a dozen of us independently working across the country in our little silos, and we didn't really know about each other. Fast forward now, and through the work of my foundation, we've trained over 1,000 physicians in the practice model, and we have over 2,000 independent practices now up and operating in this practice model, which is known as direct primary care. So if you wanted to do a web search for direct primary care, you'd find a practice probably right near you. We're operating in all 50 states with independent practices.
Hmm. That's pretty handy.
But you're absolutely right. I mean, we have an addiction in this country to insurance. We think that coverage is health care. Coverage is not health care. I think Obamacare has proven that giving somebody a card does not mean they have access to health care.
Yeah, that's true. And I do think that people got that exactly backwards. The other thing, maybe when we come back, like my particular physician is not part of any health plan, and so he has a lot more latitude than many. He can, you know, accept coverage if he wants. They bill it, but they're not part of the system. Like they can bill Blue Shield for me, but they're not part of the Blue Shield network. So when we come back, you know, decode that for us too. I don't know how that actually works, but that sort of helps the people who do have coverage through their work. And I don't know. I think it helps my doctor, too, at the end of the day, because he gets paid and I get reimbursed. So
sure.
We will come right back. Our guest is Dr. Lee Gross. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. There behind the glass stands a real blade of grass. Be careful as you pass. Move along, move along. Come inside, the show's about to start. Guaranteed to blow your head apart.
And we're back. Okay, so the $64,000 question. You have insurance through your workplace, and it isn't the hospital like those guys have. And they want to go to you as their doctor. Can you bill for them?
So in our particular practice, we do not bill on a fee-for-service basis, but what employers, there are several different ways employers can get involved in this if they want to. So employers can fund a health reimbursement arrangement. So if the employee goes and shops for this, the employer can reimburse them for it. It's tax-free to the employer. It's tax-free to the employee. You can use health savings accounts for these sorts of things, which, again, employers and employees can contribute tax-free and pay for them. You can use flexible spending accounts. So if an employee wants to dedicate certain amounts of money at the beginning of the year tax-free towards medical spending, they can sign up for these as well. Plus, if you do other, you know, non-traditional insurance type things, so if your employer is self-funded through insurance, then they can create what's called an ERISA plan that's built around the practice model as well. So they can just build it directly into the structure of the health plan for the employer. So there are lots of ways that employers can integrate this sort of thing through it. Again, whether it's just reimbursed directly by the employer or whether it's paid directly by the employee, but there are certainly plenty of ways for it to be done.
Interesting.
So they would participate in your plan, but then would they also have a secondary plan for the majors?
Yeah, so if it's an employer-sponsored health plan, then you're bound by all the rules that affect employers at the state and federal level. So you'd still have to have major medical coverage for hospitalizations and drugs and preventive services outside of the direct primary care offices. All those things would still have to be covered. Just like it would be for any other business. What we find is that direct primary care gives you, it eliminates a lot of the financial barriers to accessing care. It also gives more personalized time. So if if any of your listeners have gone to a physician lately, you'll know that the doctor is very rushed. Most of the time is spent with their face in the computer clicking boxes. The office visit is probably, 7 minutes long, and of those 7 minutes, 3 minutes, maybe actually the doctor talking to you and listening to your problems. But the rest of the time is spent trying to build the encounter and to do an interaction which satisfies the rules of the federal government, Medicare, Medicaid, and the insurance companies in order for them to get paid.
Hmm.
Those don't happen in a direct primary care practice because our computer systems aren't cash registers. They're not. Our office visits are not designed to extract as much money out of the patient's insurance company as possible and to repeat it as many times as possible. That's not how it's done. And so the employee or the patient does not have to wonder, if they have enough money to actually see the doctor for this particular problem and how much it's going to cost me. So, for example, let's say you go see the doctor for a physical with your traditional insurance. Now, as you know, most physicals have to be free. It's a preventive service, and under the law, it's required that there's no cost sharing for that. No deductibles apply. But if you go into your doctor's visit and you say, "Oh, doc, by the way, since I took the day off of work, my knee's been bothering me." Well, all of a sudden, that's no longer a physical. That's now an evaluation and management of a knee pain problem. And it's now billed as two separate visits, and you receive it, and the second one actually applies towards your deductible, and you get a surprise $200 bill in the mail. That creates animosity between the doctor and the patient. and creates it, it looks like the doctor billed it wrong or the doctor's taking advantage. But in fact, the system is so broken that it creates barriers and obstacles between the doctor and patient where they can't be honest with each other and share the problems that are actually going on in their lives that really will have, effectively have meaning for them.
Hmm. Yeah, I can see where that
would
be.
Didn't even think about that.
Bad issue. You mentioned prescriptions. What about medications under your plan?
So most of the direct primary care practices in the country dispense medications wholesale directly from their practices. So much like Sam's Club and BJ's and Costco, the warehouse clubs, they can sell things at less price because they make their money on the memberships. The same thing with our practices. We make our revenue off of our membership, so we do not need to charge extra retail for our prescriptions. So we can dispense whole generic medications at pennies on the dollar. So in almost all situations, our prescriptions are cheaper than the pharmacy, they're cheaper than Walmart, because, you know, there's no retail markup with that. The name brand medications are still very expensive. There's really nothing you can do about that in the direct primary care practice, but you can manage diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol for probably less than $5 a month.
Yeah, that's a substantial savings.
And that's the stuff that people are dealing with for the most part. So I'm assuming it's kind of like homeschool. You guys kind of remind me of the homeschool for medical, you know. Is the government coming for you to try to squeeze you out now that you found this, what I'm sure they consider to be a loophole?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a state-by-state issue where some states are friendlier than others. We have legislation that's passed in 30 different states to protect the practice model specifically. Hmm. So the question is, if a doctor and patient are contracted directly with one another, and does the doctor become a risk-bearing entity, and should the doctor be regulated as an insurance company? And so, again, 30 states have weighed in on this issue, and 30 states have come down on the side that the doctor is not an insurance company and they're exempt from regulation. The issues that we tend to see more at the federal level, that's just in the tax treatment issues of it. So, you know, we've had probably about 7 years worth of debate in Congress and through multiple administrations at the White House as to how the IRS and Treasury Department will deem this relationship, which is sort of where the big, you know, the big special interests can sort of get involved and try to you know, shift the playing field basically against the practices that do it. But all in all, despite the fact that there's lots of headwinds across the country, you're still seeing massive uptick in growth of these practice models. And again, we're growing in all 50 states despite the obstacles that lie in the way. The challenge, of course, is then building the health plans around them that support them to provide the coverage for the what-ifs. But, you know, the fact that the system is so broken still has created immense amounts of opportunity and immense innovation. So you have things like health sharing ministries that have continued to grow and spread, and innovation is happening in those areas. You have immense innovation in the technology areas where you're now having lots of telemedicine, which is dramatically increasing access to specialty care, particularly in rural areas. So that's something that's been incredibly important during the pandemic. These direct primary care practices have thrived during the pandemic, whereas the traditional fee-for-service primary care practices were nearly bankrupt by the federal response to these.
Right, because everybody had to stay home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and
everybody had to stay home. It took Medicare 3 months to recognize the invention of the telephone. So if your practice model depends upon physically seeing somebody in person in your office in order to bill their insurance to get paid, and then you've created an environment where people are unable or are afraid to leave their homes, you've essentially cut off the revenue supply of all of your outpatient physician practices,
sure,
which is exactly what happened last year.
Sure.
So our practices, the practices that operate under our model, they didn't need to wait 3 months for an insurance company to convene a committee to decide to pay for telehealth services. We just did it on day number one. Our patients didn't go out without their medications. We did parking lot visits. We did house calls. We did absolutely everything that we needed to do to make sure our patients got the access to care in a timely manner without being blocked out of the access to their physician.
So let's say a patient utilizes the telehealth or teledoc system. You get to talk to your doctor, and he says, "Okay, you need XYZ medication." Do they just do they mail you the medication at that point? How's that work?
So there are certainly, you know, individual telehealth systems, teledoc systems that you can do that. And typically, you know, they'll be able to send in a prescription into your local pharmacy if that's the service that you're using. If you're having a direct primary care practice where the person you're actually doing telehealth is your personal physician, then there are lots of options, anything from converting that, that telehealth visit into either a house call or in-office visits in order to do some, you know, testing that can't be done over the telephone. You know, there are times when physicians will just come in over the weekend and sew up lacerations or set broken bones. But the, you know, more traditional telehealth, systems that are drastically growing, you know, those can't be converted into in-person visits. So it is exclusively a technology visit. You, of course, you can do things over video and take pictures of rashes and so forth and you know, consult your doctor based upon the photos. Which again is a tremendous benefit for people that have not traditionally had great access to care because of, you know, whether the practices are spread out or it's a rural community and you just don't have physicians out there.
Yeah. Yeah. We've never had that technology before. So, again, this is a great reason for the government to kind of update their practice in Medicare, Medicaid.
Well, the crazy part is the VA has been using telehealth for a while. Mm-hmm. And have they, is it new that they've allowed private physicians to use that?
It's the issue with the private physicians doing telehealth is that the insurance traditionally didn't pay for it. What they would say is, well, if you're having a conversation with somebody on the phone, that should have been bundled into your previous office visit or your next office visit, so therefore we're not going to pay for it. And if they did pay for it, usually they paid pennies on the dollar for what the doctor would have made had they brought him into the office. And so
right.
If you do the visit over the telephone, you get paid $15. If you do it in person, you get paid $180. And so the incentive is to bring everybody into the office because that's the practice model. So during this pandemic, what Medicare did was they changed the rules and they said they're going to pay the same amount for a telehealth visit as they will for an in-person visit, which is great because that was necessary to keep the private practices alive. The problem is you created a lot of incentive for fraud and abuse within the telehealth system that we're going to have to sort of sort out as this goes along. But again, it created awareness of the ability for the telehealth services. It created demand for the services. And now that people are actually utilizing the service, they're realizing there's quite a bit of value in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the other thing that I see like through the VA system, which is typically the poster child for not having government-run healthcare, works great if you just need one little thing. But if you're having a, you know, if you have something that requires, especially if you live in a rural area like we do and you need any kind of specialty stuff, it's a gauntlet. I mean, it's just a gauntlet for scheduling and everything else. But one of our clinics up here was without a psychiatrist and has been for, I don't know, 5 years now probably. They started using telehealth for that. And initially people really didn't like it, but it gave them access to doctors all over the place. And so I started hearing back from veterans. They were like, well, I kind of like it now. I found this new guy in, you know, Georgia or something. I mean, they're talking to people all over the place. Is telehealth in your type of model, are you able to bring in people from all over, or do you keep it kind of the normal people they would see?
Well, in my, you know, particular model, it's usually the telehealth specifically with your own patients, and it's a state-by-state level in terms of whether or not you can interact with patients out of state, you know, whether you need to be licensed in the practice where the physician is located or licensed in the practice where the patient's located. And if that's across state lines, every state treats that interaction differently.
Sure.
So that's a little bit tricky. And same thing with prescription of medications. If you're going across state lines, and the physician may not be licensed in the state where the prescription is going to, it creates issues where a doctor may be practicing without a license. But the important thing I think to note about the VA, first of all, what the VA is good at, they're very good at. You know, they do an excellent job in certain areas that just the private sector can't compete with. because they're able to put immense resources into things that the private sector probably would not find profitable. The problem is that when the VA is stressed to its limit, it has to go to the private sector to bail it out.
Yep.
And so when you create a single payer system, a one-size-fits-all government-run system, and the system is stretched to its max, there is no private sector to fall to. You just don't get access. And that's what you see in a lot of countries with socialized medicine, is you start creating waiting lists and rationing care and setting up rules who qualifies for services and who doesn't. Right now with the VA, they just give people a voucher and they give them, you know, the ability to go out and find their own doctors, and they get paid back for it.
Yeah, that kind of depends. And then, you know, they had a program for a while where the reimbursement was just not being done in a timely fashion, and I mean like a year and a half out on payment. And so then when they came back and said, well, hey, we're going to go back to a community care model, and you can use a physician in the community if we approve it. That's the other thing. You can't just go do it. They have to wave the magic wand and let you go do it. Then the physician has to say, okay, we'll take the reimbursement. But so many of them got burned during that time period. They were like, eh, we're not going to do that anymore. Like they already owe us $1 zillion. We're gonna just pass on that and deal with everybody else. But it becomes tough because you have to go through the primary care physician to get to everything. They're the gatekeeper, and I understand why they do that. I mean, you don't want everybody just running around willy nilly like a smorgasbord, going to all sorts of specialists. But it puts a huge amount of pressure on the primary care system.
It does, and there's also a tremendous amount of turnover in the primary care system within the VA, so it's hard to maintain any sort of continuity, so you'll never have the same doctor twice.
Right, which makes the gatekeeper model kind of stupid. I mean, because they're not really the gatekeeper. They don't really know that patient at all.
And so what ends up happening is those VA patients usually seek out people like me who provide the bulk of their primary care, and then if they need a prescription filled by the VA, typically, they'll take my prescription that I write, take it to their VA primary, and then the VA primary usually just rewrites the prescription that I've written. So now we're sort of duplicating services.
Yeah, because they can't take your prescription and have it filled by the VA. It has to come from one of their doctors. So yeah, it duplicates that every single time. That's not even optional, which is totally dumb.
But we create the access that the VA can't do.
So, correct.
You know, the VA really does encourage people to have private primaries, because the VA primaries certainly do not have the capacity in many communities to see people when they're sick. They don't have the capacity to get people in for acute illnesses. They don't have the capacity if things are generally not going well to see you same day or next day. You know, you can get in 2 or 3 weeks. That's not universal across the board, and I'm sure that's different in various pockets of the country, but in some areas it can take you 2 or 3 months to get into primary.
Oh, yeah, and sometimes longer. I mean, the one thing we did see was when Obamacare came in, I'm sure the rest of the country saw it too, you had a lot of doctors who said, yeah, you know what, I think I'm going to not be a doctor anymore. I'm just not doing this. And or they went to work for a hospital and became, you know, basically a hospitalist and stopped seeing private patients. So you had this huge crushing down of the people who would be family doctors. And so the private system, the VA system, all the systems are really, really short in that capacity.
Oh, yeah. A lot of new doctors weren't going into GP care.
That's true.
There's no money. You know, exactly.
Other interesting dynamic that's happening now is that, you know, because you've disincentivized people to go into primary care for a multitude of reasons. You know, I don't think people go into medical school because they want to be a gatekeeper. I mean, that's not something I know too many kids that dream of when they're children, is I want to be a gatekeeper when I grow up. But that's, you know, the position that many of the health plans and the government has sort of put you in. And of course it's the lowest paying physician specialty. So, you know, it's a sort of, you know, oath of poverty on a physician level to spend that kind of money into medical school and training and come out of $500,000 in debt and then to want to go into primary care. It just doesn't make a whole lot of financial sense for people. So it's creating sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy where you have a shortage of primary care doctors. But you're building a system that's heavily reliant on primary care doctors in order to implement.
Yeah, I guess so that's kind of kind of where I was going with that is, yeah, you need them more than ever, but you've disincentivized people to go into that field. So where are those folks going to come from? We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'd like to hear your guess on maybe how we fix that or get out of that.
Yeah, how do we cut the bureaucracy and kind of upgrade our our system to take advantage of
stop the train wreck?
Yeah.
All right, we'll be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us, Bill.
Oh, .us, yeah, sorry.
I told him the tens you left me. I was feeling like just about dead. Well, doctor, what can you give me? And could it take one or two? Can you tell me just what it's gonna do? Will it save me from what I'm going through? Will it ease the pain? Will it ease the pain? Will it help to pacify my brain?
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor, my eyes.
Pretty good doctor music out there.
Yeah.
I always like doctor shows. I'm like, ooh, got a lot of doctor music. It's kind of fun. So how do you think we're getting out of the train wreck of no primary physicians and the really the, you know, you don't have much of a farm team at this point? Like, I know I have a niece who would have gone to medical school, and then she kind of looked at the cost of going to medical school and the cost of going to physician assistant school, the amount of time it would take, the debt she'd walk away with, and opted for physician assistant, which is too bad because she's really, really smart. She would have been a great doctor.
Well, she's a great physician. She'll be a great physician assistant. And so we need great physician assistants. Yeah, so that's an area that's rather controversial.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, I think a lot of people will say, well, you know, primary care doctors really are probably overtrained. You really don't need that degree of training to do primary care medicine. So, you know, just a physician assistant really unsupervised probably could do primary care, and a nurse practitioner unsupervised probably can do primary care, because primary care is easy mostly if it's, you know, you're just gonna basically doing basic stuff, treating stuffy noses, and everything else goes out to specialists. And in the model that's been built, where the doctors are the primary care providers are all so darn busy that they basically are practicing checkbook, you know, checkbox medicine, just clicking boxes and doing whatever they're told, and every visit is so high-paced and pressured that you really don't have time to do anything other than refer patients out for every single little thing. Then it does create a system where pretty much anybody with any degree of training really could do primary care medicine because you're not really practicing medicine at that point. And so, you know, there's a big push in many parts of the country to say, let's let, you know, people go into primary care without supervision, regardless of their level of training. That in my circles is, again, it's a rather controversial thing because, you know, our general thought is that if you actually stop the bureaucracy and actually gave the physicians more time to practice medicine, that much of the stuff that is sent away is not sent away because the doctor is not capable of taking care of it. It's simply because the doctor doesn't have the time. But given the time, the doctor doesn't need to refer out all the diabetes for management. The doctor doesn't need to refer out the rheumatological conditions, the rheumatoid arthritis. All that stuff can be managed at the primary care level. It's only the most complex stuff that really needs to go. So I think it's important to have
that's your detective, though. See, like, I always have weird things, and so I count on my primary care doctor to be a good detective and always be picking up clues. And like Bill's primary care doctor, yeah, he referred him out for a, what do you call it, treadmill thing.
Yeah.
And just he
stress
wasn't,
test.
Yeah, he was fine. He wasn't sick.
Yeah, wasn't
he
sick.
Wasn't having any
no
stuff.
Symptoms.
No, he goes out for his little treadmill thing and winds up with 7 heart stents because he had 2 major blockages. Surprise!
And we used to do stress tests in our office until Medicare stopped paying for it. Mm. You know, as primary care physicians, we had training in doing stress tests, so it didn't require a referral out to the cardiologist to do that. That was certainly within the realm of a primary care. You know, if you have basically one of the number one causes of death in the country is heart disease, and your primary care doctor doesn't have the ability to do a stress test to detect that, if it requires a referral for it, again, you're creating obstacles to the delivery of care. And in no way is this you know, what I said meant to be derogatory to the professionals that are physician assistants and nurse practitioners.
Well,
I mean,
no, but
exceptional training there.
Yeah, there are tons of people who get really mad too. You know, I had to pay full fare, and I didn't even see the doctor. You know, I'd see some assistant. There are a lot of people who don't consider that to be a doctor visit.
Right. But in a market-based system where people are open with their training and their credentials and backgrounds, there is a place for every single, you know, every single one of these healthcare professionals to practice, you know, you know, because there are patients that are more than happy to see a physician assistant, would rather see a physician assistant than a doctor. They would feel they're more personable, better trained, and, you know, so.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think all of these things, you know, increase access to care in the right setting with the right training and the right supervision, I think are good. And the question I get a lot is, you know, so what's the solution to healthcare.
Exactly. That was my next question.
Bill was going to wait to sandbag you in the last 2 minutes.
Well, no. What can we do to streamline the bureaucracy? Because, as you said in your article, you know, with new technologies and so forth coming out, a lot of these healthcare plans don't even pay for it. So we really still don't have access to the top. Medical care, I mean, if you can't pay for it, you're not going to get it. So, I mean, what's the solution there?
Yeah, so that's the thing, is there's not a solution. The good news is there's so much innovation happening right now. There are 1,000 solutions, and they're all happening simultaneously. But once the government puts their thumb on the scale and picks winners and losers in this process, you've stymied all innovation, and everything comes to a screeching halt.
Sure.
And so, you know, you're about to see this happen when, you know, the government's about to take over vision through this budget process they're working on. They're about to take over dental. They're about to take over hearing services. But I think you're going to see the most profound change is in vision. Because right now you can go on the internet, you can order your glasses, you can get 10 different kinds of frames, you can get progressive lenses, you can get funky colors and shapes and sizes until the government comes in and takes over. And once they do that, it's a one-size-fits-all approach. You get what you get, you don't throw a fit. And they will tell you what you can get, when you can get it, how many you can get, and how much they're going to pay for it. And beyond that, you know, they are essentially about to take over an entire industry that probably is not really consenting to the takeover by the federal government.
Right.
And so you will shut down all of the innovation that's happening within the vision industry.
Yeah.
So that's happening real time right in front of our eyes, and especially not even in front of our eyes. It's happening in backroom deals.
But there are
so many things that are happening. As long as, you know, the best thing the government can do right now is step out of the way and let it happen.
Yeah. Yeah, because pretty much everything they touch, as we've already said, you know, makes it cost more, makes it less efficient.
Sure. And, you know, when you talk about price, you know, especially in today's environment, major factor. I mean, people are going to look at, say, eyeglasses and say, you know, I know I need new glasses, but I don't have $600 or $800 before the process is all done to pay for a pair of glasses. So forget it. I'll just keep what I have or do without. So you're basically getting cut out of the process.
You are, or if you break your glasses and the government's going to say, I'm sorry, you already had your glasses this year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's, you know, I want progressive lenses. I'm sorry, you can only have bifocals. You know, your plan doesn't pay for progressive lenses. I mean, you know, that's just not offered. You know, you want the high-end fashion frames? I'm sorry, you know, look at the frames that are dispensed by the Army. Those are your options.
Yeah.
You can have any color you want as long as it's black.
As long as you want to look like you just jumped out of the casting for Nerds. Yeah.
Comes with a roll of white tape.
That's what I picture. It's like, cause that's, you know, that's what happened like in the Soviet Union. I mean, they had, I realize you don't wear glasses on your feet, but I mean, there's shoe stores. They had shoe stores for right, shoes that go on your right foot and shoes that go on your left foot. And, you know, good luck if you could find them that match.
Really?
Yeah, all the right shoes were over here and all the left shoes were over there. They were not sold as pairs. It's like, so, and you got to stand in a really long line about, for both.
You know, about, you know, expanding access to primary care and fixing those issues. If you make primary care an attractive specialty, attractive in the work setting, attractive in the satisfaction of the career, the ability to actually practice medicine like you wanted to practice medicine, and you make it financially rewarding as well, that will draw more people into the field, and that's what the direct primary care model does. Mm-hmm. If you decrease the regulatory burden on the practice, and instead of spending most of your time filling out paperwork and fighting with insurance companies, you're providing patient care, you've effectively doubled the number of patient interactions that you can have, because you're no longer treating the bureaucracy, you're treating the patient. So you've effectively doubled the number of primary care workforce within that. If you start building in the efficiencies of the technology platforms and telemedicine services, what might take somebody a half a day out of their work schedule to see a doctor can be accomplished in 3 minutes over a technology visit. So you can actually access more patients. A virtual primary care doctor can have a panel of 10,000 patients and take care of them all perfectly well.
Wow.
In our system, why can't an endocrinologist be a primary care doctor for a diabetes patient? Why can't the cardiologist be the primary doctor for a congestive heart failure patient, or a pulmonologist be a primary doctor for an asthma patient or an emphysema patient? These are the sort of things that once you take away the complexities of our billing structure and how the system is designed, it completely opens up possibilities and it eliminates all the bottlenecks, and this problem simply solves itself.
Are there other countries that are implementing this program, or is this something that's kind of new to the U.S.?
The National Health Service is starting to implement something like this because of the problems that they have over in England. I'd say that the country that's probably most closely resembles this model is probably Singapore, where almost everything in Singapore is a cash transaction. For routine services, primary care is all cash. Most all your specialty care is cash. And all the high-end stuff is done through insurance, which is, you know, public-private partnership,
right,
to offer coverage for hospitalizations and surgeries, major surgeries and so forth.
Hmm. Well, shoot, that was a fast hour.
Yeah, it worked.
That was a very fast hour. Dr. Lee Gross has been our guest this hour, talking about the public option is the wrong approach to healthcare reform. Thank you, Doctor, for being with us, and I hope people will go read your article. You can find it at wethepeopleradio.us. Welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape Machinery is located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City, just off 55 between Oasis and Pine Grove exits. Go up and see them if you're looking for a tractor or a mower or implements. You need parts or service. They do it all up there. Or give them a call at 226-9226. A lot of knowledgeable people up there can get you fixed up and on your way. So you can also get them on the web at papemachinery.com.
And hurry up and do it before Governor Newsom's edict comes in and you're not allowed to have gas powered.
Oh yeah, no gas power. Yeah. We're planning ahead on that. So hopefully we'll be well prepared if that thing does actually go into effect. I think there's probably going to be some lawsuits before all that happens.
Can you imagine?
But it's set for 2023, so it's not too far off.
You have to mow 5 acres with an electric.
With an electric mower. Yeah,
by the time you get to one end, you got to start over at the other end because you've been recharging it the whole time.
Just carry about 40 pounds of extra batteries with you. You'll get through it.
No big deal. Or a really, really long extension cord.
Other than the fact, I'm not sure they have the technology for a riding electric mower yet, but... hey, who knows? This is liable to spawn all kinds of technology.
Your Prius can double as a mower.
Oh, there you go.
You just drag one behind it.
Just mount a belly mower on it, and there. Away you go.
Belly mower on a Prius.
There you are.
Got to be a joke in there somewhere.
Sure, there is.
That's bad visual anyway. Wow. So poor Lawrence Mead is offered to come on with us today.
What are these guys talking about?
Sorry, Mr. Mead.
Are you coming? Are you from California? Have I got that right?
Yeah. I want to point this out. I'm not from here. I just live here now.
So. Okay.
I'm from two other bad places, though, that have all gone crazy. So I'm starting to feel somewhat responsible. I was born in Washington State. I grew up in Connecticut, and now I live in California. And it's like, well, what the hell? It's a total downhill slide.
Yeah, and I am from here, but I'm more and more feeling like a hostage, so I'm always planning an escape at some point.
We have neighbors escaping all the time. It's like, hey, where did those people go?
Hey.
Oh, they moved to Montana. Where are those people? Mm-hmm. Oh, they moved to Idaho. Well, what the heck?
Yeah.
Only we're going to be left at the fruits and nuts, like the jokes.
Yep.
It's all going to be true. All jokes are true at some point. Ugh. So I think we've spoken with you before. But I
you probably did a couple of years ago when Burdens of Freedom first came out.
Yes.
And I did like 70 interviews about it. And
you mean you don't remember us?
Now. What's that?
You mean you don't remember us?
Well, it was so many.
I'm kidding.
The interviews were organized by Steve Manfredi, who is a publicist who does this, and we had like twice as many interviews as he expected, so that showed a lot of interest, and I was much encouraged by that.
Yeah, I saw your name pop up, and I thought, hey, wait a second, we know that guy. So not to cheat people, you're a professor of politics at New York University.
That's right.
And you wrote The Burdens of Freedom, Cultural Difference in American Power.
Yeah.
But since then, I think this is new, that you're the host of Poverty and Culture.
Well, what's happening now is we're doing a podcast based on the book called Poverty and Culture. And in connection with that, I'm writing a number of op-eds that set out arguments based on the book, and the one that you've got, the one about Afghanistan, is an example of that. The Afghanistan collapse, is the only way to put it, dramatizes really the idea of cultural difference, because what Afghanistan represented was a complete opposite of what the United States represented. And the collapse of Afghanistan is really a tragedy much more for Afghanistan than it is for us. We're going to recover from this. But whether they recover is very much in doubt.
Yeah.
I thought your view of this, I mean, I think we've all noticed that regardless of what channel you watch, all the news is exactly the same. They seem to hit everything from the exact same vantage point. And you looked at this from a very different angle that I thought was important for people to think about.
It was a very interesting article, by the way.
Yeah, well, thank you. The idea of cultural difference, the idea that everyone isn't the same, all countries are not the same, all groups are not the same, that they differ by culture, that is a radical point of view, which has really pretty well been suppressed because many people think you can't talk about culture without implicitly making statements about race. And I'm not making that connection. On the contrary, my sources say very clearly that cultural difference is not about race. It's something quite different. It has to do with what life's about, what people think it's about. And in Afghanistan, you see dramatized this huge contrast between the way Afghans think what they think their lives are about and what the United States thinks. And we emerge, although our departure was certainly embarrassing, we emerged with far better credit than they did. They are in much, much deeper trouble.
Yeah. I mean, and the culture, when it gets down to the culture, I think that's the point that that is kind of blaring at everybody right now is, why did this happen? Well, it's it's not America, and we're not going to make it America. Their culture is just different.
Yeah, and it's not only that we can't, they're not going to turn into America, but we don't have any magic answer in which a country could turn into America. That isn't easy because it does require a certain way of life. And it just happens to be that the Western world, and especially the United States, has had a very distinctive culture for as long as it's been around. And that makes us different from the rest of the world. And that contrast holds, according to my sources, even though the West and the non-West are both very diverse within themselves. You have a lot of differences, religious, cultural, language, history, are very different from place to place. But this general contrast between an individualist culture found in the West and the non-individualist found in the non-West, that holds. And that is remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not something, I mean, you know, people say, oh, we were there for 20 years, they should have been able to run their own show. Well,
Yeah,
they've been around for thousands of years, and 20 years is nothing.
That's right. Now, you can have an impact if you stay longer. I mean, the best example here is India. The British controlled India for almost 200 years. Mm-hmm. And although it is a radically non-Western country, they were able to implant certain Western institutions. So in India, you have an elected government, you have a bureaucracy, you have a legal system. The education system also resembles what you find in England. So India has some aspects of a Western culture, and that's one reason why it is better governed today than most countries in the non-Western world. But it's still not a Western country because the bulk of the society is still living a very different life from what you find in the United States or Britain.
Right. And like you say, that was after 200 years of influence from the West, and they came up with their own version of it, which is, you know, way better than Afghanistan. But 20 years in Afghanistan, it was pretty obvious they didn't really adapt to our culture at all.
That's right. And it's not clear they could have done because they'd never really had a central government. They had a capital where there was certain people hold for offices, but they never really controlled the country.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's the thing that we don't ask about. We focus mostly on whether countries are democratic. We take it for granted that they control their territories, but they often don't. I mean, the idea that you control your territory is only true in a strongly governed country that has the rule of law, and that is what you find in the West in a few Asian countries. But that's about it. Mm-hmm. You don't find it elsewhere, and therefore there's no point in even talking about democracy until you have control of a territory.
Right, right.
But I thought your point was well made about the difference between that individual, the view of individualism that they don't share.
Yeah, that's right. It's paradoxical because you would not expect that an individual's culture, as you find in the West, would also have strong government. After all, we criticize government. We're constantly critical of our leaders. And you might think that a government like that would be weaker than you find in many non-Western countries where authority is deferred to. But the opposite is true. And the reason is that part of the individual's culture is this moralistic idea of right and wrong. I mean, people believe in things like the Ten Commandments as if they were absolutely true. And they learn these in childhood. And then from that point on, they have ideas about right and wrong. They're quite rigid in general, theoretical. And they apply them to all the situations that they encounter, including politics and government. So this is why we don't have serious corruption in the United States, because people understand that that's wrong. Sure, there are people who break the laws, but we go after them. And we actually apprehend people who hold public office and throw them in jail for that. I mean, this is hard to understand in the non-Western world, certainly in Afghanistan, where there was systemic corruption. You know, that doesn't happen in Western countries because people understand that's wrong, and the authorities have authority to go after people who break the laws, and they do so.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have the rule of law, and that's why the government is able to govern.
Right. And over there, I mean, their culture is It doesn't have that built in. No. You know, corruption is.
They're kind of operating on the might makes right.
Yeah. I had a business associate tell me one time we were attempting to do some business in Russia, and they said you have to be very careful there because in Russia they believe if they can screw you in a business deal, which is very unethical here. They look at that as just being a better business person than you.
Yeah.
And there's the culture difference.
Yeah. Or in the case of Asia, you also have a slightly different attitude. There, I don't think they would expressly set out to screw their associates. But if conditions change and you've got a contract that makes, and the contract becomes unadvantageous because changing conditions, Asians will ask you to modify it. They'll say, well, we have to help out the other side of the bargain because they're going to lose here, so let's change the deal. Well, America, you don't do that. You make a deal, you stick with it. You know,
right.
The Asians are very sensitive to the feelings of other people around them. So what's right and wrong tends to be determined by the attitudes of those that you know personally.
Right.
See, whereas for Americans, it's much more general and absolute. You know, we made a deal here, and the rules say such and such, and you have to do it. That's all there is to it. Maybe you made a mistake. Okay, do it different the next time. But right now, the law says you got to obey it, you know,
right.
Or we'll take you to court. And the judges are not on the take.
Right. And it's funny, you know, most of, if not all of your Middle Eastern countries are that way. I mean, their culture, I don't want to say more, isn't as sophisticated, but they just look at things and have dealt with things so differently than we have from the very beginning.
Yeah.
That's just the way it is.
Yeah. See, one of the reasons we don't understand how different this is because we were that way from the start. And the reason is we inherited these institutions from the British. And the British developed them over centuries. And therefore, it's the development process whereby we got the rule of law is something we never really witnessed directly. We got it from the Brits.
Mm-hmm.
And even though we had differences with them, the idea that we were profoundly against the British, really the opposite is true. Although we didn't want them to rule us and we want to have an independent country, although that's true, the fundamental institutions in America are British. They really go to the rule of law, government by consent. That's unquestioned in America.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the constitutional details are different, but that's not really fundamental. What really matters is that we have the rule of law, government by consent, and the British have had those things for something like 1,000 years. I mean, the British genius in politics is beyond explanation. They are way, way ahead of the rest of the world in developing good government. And still today, very few countries equal them in their capacity to run a law-based and democratically-based system, which has broad consent, which is supported by virtually everybody in the country. They have other issues. They're divided over many questions, but it never affects the basic institutions. And we inherited all that. We don't even see it. We think that this is somehow easy. And we think everybody could do it, but they didn't have the same history.
Yeah, they don't have the base.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
We didn't just invent it out of nowhere a couple hundred years ago, and then
Americans were already governing themselves, even under the British. Local officials tended to be locally people who had already taken office according to the rules, and when the revolution broke out, they simply moved into the same offices the British used to hold. And people like Jefferson, he was already an experienced public official at the time of the Revolution. And the same with Washington and the other leading figures. So they knew what they were doing. They were already experienced. And their issues with the British were not about that. It was about more fundamental issues about taxes and control, all that. I mean, they had reasons to fight the British, but they never had to worry about the basics.
Right. Yeah, because that was basically an agreed upon model.
Unconscious of it, and they also the other thing the founders did was just assume that everybody could do the same, And ever since then, we've had an idea that we can just go out and turn other countries into democracies because it's easy. After all, we did it.
Yeah, we're going to model it for them.
Well, and the other thing is, it's like, just try it. You'll like it. You know, we have this, why wouldn't they?
I know.
And we erase the, those major cultural differences. We have to take a really quick break, but we will be back with our guest, Lawrence Mead. And you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sometimes I want to light up underneath the no smoking sign. Sometimes I wish they'd tell me how justice got so blind. I wish they'd just leave me alone, 'cause I'm doing alright. You can take your change on down the road and leave me here with mine. 'Cause that ain't my America, that ain't this country's roots. You wanna slam old Uncle Sam, but I ain't letting you. I'm mad as hell and you know I still bleed red, white, and blue. They
God, for my life, for the stars and stripes, may freedom forever fly. Let it ring, salute the ones who die, the ones that give their lives, so we don't have to sacrifice all the things we love, like our chicken fried and cold beer on a Friday night, a pair of jeans that fit just right. And the radio,
I thought that was a really good list of all the things we can't export.
Cold beer on a Saturday night. Yeah, they probably haven't done that over there.
They'd be like, you what?
What?
We're going to wear pants? We don't do pants. Well, we were, Bill and I were talking in the break there that, I mean, just the family situation. You know, we've seen it in this country. I don't know why this is so tough. But we've seen it with, for instance, the Laotian community that came, you know, that we brought over here after Vietnam.
Yeah.
You had the women went to school, and the men would go to school, but it was culturally inappropriate for the men to not know what they were doing. So the men sat in the back. They didn't try to learn. The women did, so they were eligible to get jobs. The kids spoke the language, so they kind of ran the family.
Yep.
It turned their whole world upside down, and they lived here.
Yeah, the reason was that they're trying to apply in America the way of life that they brought from home. And that's natural, but it doesn't work very well here. Mm-hmm. And you have to adopt a more inner-driven style. Now, other Asians who've been more selected come in here with a better adjustment. They still have a lot to learn, but they're further along the road than people who come who are airlifted here, as the Vietnamese were, or currently the Afghans coming from the breakdown in Afghanistan. They're going to have a very tough time because all they knew was that they helped out the Americans in Afghanistan, but they don't have any idea what they're getting into when they come here. That's going to be really difficult. I anticipate there are going to be serious adjustment problems.
Well, and I don't think it's just with, I mean, Latin America. I mean, even the countries down there are so corrupt. That's why people are coming here. But they come here with no knowledge or education on how this system works, and they're going to bring that culture with them.
Yeah, that's right. See, the central difference is that they come with an attitude, very understandable given their background, they come with an attitude of survival.
Right.
For them, life is about survival. And so what you do is you adjust to demands made from you, made on you by the outside. Various forces impinge on you and tell you to do various things. So you have to do those things. And they're rather good at survival. But in America, that's not the main thing about the way life is lived. Most Americans are inner-driven, not outer-driven. They have goals that they're seeking to achieve. And they may be quite modest. They want to get a better job. They want to move to the suburbs. They want to send their children to college. things like that. But their lives are organized around those tasks. And it's that that gives the society its dynamism, the fact that people are moving ahead in their own lives and they're inner-driven. This is the thing that makes the society so productive. Mm-hmm. They're not just engaging in survival.
Right.
They are moving ahead. And it's that inner-driven quality. It's also the basis for the moral differences that I described before, where attitudes about right and wrong are inner-driven. They come from basic views about right and wrong, which people learn in childhood, and they carry with them through life. And these are not situational, whereas in the non-Western world, they tend to be situational. What's right and wrong depends upon other people's pressures around you. They tell you what's right and wrong. And you might have to go along with a corrupt arrangement because that's what other people are doing. And you go with the flow. You go with what other people want you to do. Well, that's not the American way. We don't go with the flow.
Right.
We go with our inner convictions, mostly.
Right.
And that is what gives the society its crackling dynamism. People have inner views about what should be done and what they want to do. And there's debate about what ought to be done. People don't agree about that, but the actions have a depth that comes from their own convictions, whereas you typically don't find that in the non-Western world. I mean, this is what's really different about the West. It's not clear how it arose. It arose a long time ago, goes back to the Middle Ages, but we don't find anything like this in the non-Western world, even though there's so much other difference. That's the puzzle.
Yeah, that's such a great point that they have a survival mentality.
Yeah.
As opposed to people in this country have, it's achievement based. It's they want to do better. They learn the system and then they operate within it.
Well, the fundamental difference is that the Western view of life is an active one where people take initiative to achieve their goals. Whereas in the non-Western world, the fundamental stance is passive and reactive. People are waiting to be told what to do based on outside forces, and they don't take initiative. So what you don't find is the same depth of problem solving that you find in a Western country. Typically, in America and in Europe, you find people who are trying to improve things. They disagree with what's going on now, and they want to improve it, and they take action. Some of this will be in government. Some will be in the private sector. Just listening to the ads on your program, these are local businesses who have different ideas about how to serve the public, and they're all trying to find a better way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So they're inner-driven, and they're responding to the market, but they're not just surviving. They're trying to achieve something.
Right.
See, that's the difference.
So,
and,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. No, that's basically my point.
Well, what I'm thinking now is, okay, we have imported, tens of thousands of immigrants that have that survival mentality, which, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but it's not our culture.
That's right.
How do you see that impacting us and them in this country?
Well, there are a number of studies that show that it takes maybe three generations for new immigrants to fully adjust to American attitudes. And in that time, they're not going to be adjusting optimally. They're going to have various problems. But eventually, the children are usually out in front of the adults. They will go to school, and they will learn a different way of life there. And that is the main experience that causes people to shift their views away from survival.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes a while. And the groups we've had recently, I'm thinking here of Hispanics coming from Latin America, also blacks who come from slavery initially, and you may say, well, they're not really immigrants. Well, they really are, because they came from Africa, which is a very, very different society from the U.S., and then they didn't really leave that culture until they moved from the South to northern cities in the 20th century.
Yeah.
And much of the problem we have with poverty today, I think, is due to the fact that the seriously poor are still living a life of survival, which they learned in Africa and then endured through slavery and Jim Crow for all of that time.
Sure.
And those blacks that are getting ahead are those who have gone native and become individualist. And they, in fact, are doing rather well. They're getting ahead. They're doing the things that our society rewards. Others, however, are still getting by day by day. And that is basically not very constructive. So, I mean, the recent politics has been to blame all that on white racism, but that really isn't plausible. There's no evidence that that's really true. Rather, it's because the culture is just different from what this country is based on.
Sure.
And we don't see that because we have this attitude that everyone's the same.
Right.
No,
we
think we have to believe that.
But see, they've really embraced this victim mentality, and that tribalism that comes with victimhood keeps people stuck in places where they cannot be successful.
Well, one of the things that you said in your article here was the non-West cultures are generally more passive than individualists.
Yes, that's right.
And that, I think that says a lot.
Yeah, that's the fundamental difference, it seems to me. See, the identity politics idea that everything is due to racism, what that does is assign all power to the outside environment. The individual then becomes powerless. Or you're waiting to find out what you can do or not do because other people are going to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
See, that is very much the attitude of the non-Western world. I mean, it's
right.
A theory invented in American universities, but the basic idea is coming from the non-West, and that is very, very strange. I mean, it's contradictory, for starters. I mean, if you think you're oppressed by white people, then it doesn't make any sense to turn around and ask them to save you, which is what they're now doing.
Right,
And that's contradictory. If the oppressors are oppressing you, then the last thing you can do is look to them for a solution. Rather, you have to assign power to yourself and move ahead in the ways that you're able to do. Don't wait for them to tell you what to do. Do the things that you find constructive. I mean, that's what they ought to do, and that's what the black middle class is doing. That is the shift that has to happen, and the place it's going to happen mostly is going to be in the schools. I mean, the most effective charter schools we have are schools in which teachers make demands on students to learn the basics of how to operate within the society, and to show good behavior, to listen to the teacher, and so on, learn the basic skills. But then after that, you leave school, and now you are equipped to go out and pursue your own goals, whatever those are.
Exactly. And do you think, in light of the current administration's policies on immigration, aren't we kind of green-lighting the whole come here and we'll take care of you?
Yep.
I mean, that's exactly where they're coming from.
That's right. And it also reflects, to me, one of the great virtues of Western culture is it has a strong moral commitment to helping the less fortunate, including mm-hmm. people who are coming from other societies. We do indeed have a conviction to do that, which goes to the Bible. This is basically a conviction you find in the Old Testament, New Testament. People who are unfortunate should be helped, and we're in favor of that. But there's a limit to what we can do, and the current advocates of immigration set no limits at all. Essentially, they would have the whole world come to America mm-hmm. and then assume that we should take care of them. Well, that's not practical. It's not even reasonable to expect that we would do that. So what's going on at the border now is a big mistake, because those people are coming in with virtually no selection at all, no preparation to come to America. They are not to be – I mean, one attitude is that if you take the initiative – to travel for hundreds of miles to get to the border and then find a way to get across, then you must show some initiative. Well, not really. This isn't very hard to do. A lot of people do it, and they are admirable in a way, but that isn't the way forward, because obviously they're breaking the law. I mean, this is simply not allowed.
Right.
We can't allow that and have a legally governed society.
Well,
so
they're totally not equipped once they get here to be a productive part of our society, because they've been told that, you know, you'll get everything to take care of yourself.
Yeah.
Just
well,
get here.
Now, see, that actually differs with that, because the advocates talk like that, but the people who are coming across the border themselves do not make explicit claims on us. That's what the advocates do.
Mm-hmm.
They're behaving like individualists, actually. They're being moralistic. They think we should give everything to these people, okay? But the people themselves are usually extremely modest and indeed embarrassed. They know they're breaking the laws. They don't see they have any alternative. They feel absolutely powerless. But they don't talk like that. It's the advocates who talk like that. They're giving these people the wrong message. But they're actually the ones who are out of step. Those coming in now, they are indeed ill-prepared for America. I mean, I see this in my classes. People coming from Hispanic backgrounds are face such disorder in their family lives that they have a hard time concentrating on their studies. Their problem isn't that they lack ability. It's that they're overwhelmed with an environment which they just can't get control of because they're not used to being in control. They're not used to having things expected of them. They're used to survival, and they go on surviving in America, and it doesn't get them very far. So they, along with blacks, are the two groups which have the biggest change to make in taking on board what I call the burdens of freedom. And when they do that, then they're going to get somewhere. So we should concentrate on cultural change, on causing particularly young people to learn a more constructive way to live, and then they can make it.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, it's not just the immigrants that have this issue. I mean, when you talk about a cultural change, that's a big step for folks when they've never known anything but that for generations.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the attitude of the advocates is that all this is due to white racism, and if whites were simply nicer to us, everything would be fine. I don't believe that. I don't think that's what's happening here. It's really cultural difference. But that doesn't make it easy. I think the shift which has to be made by these groups is indeed very difficult. And it does involve taking on board a set of responsibilities to yourself, which you didn't have in the old country. In the old country, you didn't really have responsibility because you were in the grip of forces you had no control over.
Sure.
That is not the case in America, and you need to accept that difference.
Well, the other thing, too, it would be, it's a very different process when you decide, I think I'm going to go live in a different country. You apply for a visa, you apply for citizenship, you have to study for a test, you have to meet requirements, you need to have a job, you need to have a place to live. I mean, there's a whole plan that goes with that and a whole bunch of preparation that you do beforehand.
Yeah.
This business of here's my Joe Biden let me in a free t-shirt and my snappy new backpack and I'm gonna get shoved in a van and taken over the border or however they do it.
Yeah, you got to feel for them because they're going to hit the ground.
Different.
And, yeah,
that sets people up. I think
the groups
outcome.
Coming over the border are not going through the steps that you just described.
Right.
They're simply crossing the border illegally, and then under the asylum system, they're allowed to claim persecution in their home society, and then they get to stay.
Right, and they don't have any. There's really no plan. We have to take a really quick break, but when we come back, let's talk about that more because I think that's that goes really to the heart of what you're talking about with Afghanistan.
Yep.
We're actually importing it, which
yes, we are.
Might turn out a wee bit like we've seen on the news, which is not good.
Yeah,
we'll be right back with our guest, Lawrence Mead. He's a professor of politics at New York University. You can find everything about his article and everything about the show at wethepeopleradio.us.
I'm sick and tired of people putting it down. If you don't like it here, get the heck out of town. Go and find somewhere you love. That's fine with me. With us, or you're riding with them. Make up your mind which side you stand. If you ask me, this whole world is gone to hell. I speak the truth, but these days the truth won't sell. Wrong or right, I give my life to this place called USA.
That's us, that's right. Gotta love this American ride. Both ends of the ozone burning. Funny how the world keeps turning. Look, Ma, no hands. I love this American.
You know, we were thinking about it the other night. We were watching a TV show, and it's a series. And actually, the series moves so fast, and the dialogue is very, very quick, and much of it is inference. And as I'm watching it, I was thinking, you know, if you were from outside this country, you wouldn't have the vaguest idea what these people were talking about.
Yeah. You would not follow it at all.
You'd be totally lost.
And I think that goes along a lot with what we're talking about, and these cultural differences in some of these countries are so 180 degree from what we live and what we believe and what we just seem to know inherently, they've had no experience with.
Yeah. On the other hand, it's much worse now than it was 100 years ago. If you look at the last great immigration wave in the progressive era in the early 20th century, the assimilation problems were much less serious. And the reason was most of those people came from Europe. And so they already had an individualist view of life, and maybe not as strong as Americans, but certainly more strong than the rest of the world, more strong than the countries that are now sending immigrants in large numbers, namely Asia and Latin America. Those people have a much harder time because they don't understand that living here is not a status that you get given. It's a project. You have to do things. You have to see a goal, set goals, and approach them. That is what you don't do in most countries. Yeah, and if you come from a world of survival, you're not going to adjust well here.
Right.
And that is their basic problem.
They not only have to learn that individualist attitude, but they have to also learn to work within the boundaries of our laws and regulations that they have no idea what they are.
If there is a moral structure in the non-Western world, but it's based very much on conformity to the social pressures around you. Mm-hmm. Whereas for us, the right and wrong and the rule of law and so on are all bound up in moral absolutes, which we learn early in life. Now, I don't mean that we totally observe them. I don't think anyone ever fully observes the values that they hold. But the idea that these values are general and specific to our country is something that we don't find elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
In other societies, what counts is the pressures around you. So people come in here from these foreign countries, and then they imagine that they can do deals to get around the rules. You know, in Mexico, when the authorities accuse you of tax evasion, you negotiate with the tax authority. Well, in America, you don't negotiate with the IRS. Okay,
no.
You got to obey the rules. That's all there is to it. Or they come after you, and they're totally unapologetic about that. And this is just—I mean—we have a rigid idea about the rule of law, and we got this from the British. They also have a severe view of paying taxes. If you evade the taxes, this is a serious offense over there. So for us, it's a serious offense. We go after people that do that. And we don't, now, some people get away with it, but we don't accept it.
No.
And we don't negotiate with the authorities about this.
No.
You know, it's clear there's a right and a wrong here, and you're expected to do the right thing.
Well, do you think that the way that this is being handled, you know, people, 100,000 of them at a time, just being,
transported.
Yeah, just brought in like, you know, goods for a store shelf. And you take them in large chunks and just dump them in a town.
I don't know that that's happening. If you're talking about the Afghanistan excavation or
no, that's different. But I'm talking about the southern border.
You don't mean that. That was
of course
authorized by the government.
Correct.
And those people are being treated as refugees, and they will be handed to various localities around the country where they will have to adjust. But most of the immigration problem is at the southern border.
Yes.
Where people are coming in large numbers illegally and assuming that they can claim asylum and then regularize their status later. And we know from what's going on in Congress that Democrats are trying to authorize this, that is to give legal status to the something like 11 million people that are in the country illegally.
Which is probably like 20 or 25. I mean,
it could be larger. The point is this is outside the law and we shouldn't authorize it.
No.
Right.
This is what Republicans call amnesty, and that's exactly what it is. And I don't see how we can authorize this. I mean, what I would do is tell people to go home. I would do it gently. I would not commit violence. I would not round people up. But I would tell them, okay, we're going to change the rules. You can't get a job here now unless you're here legally, and we'll make sure that you're legal. And if you're not here legally, you're going to have to leave. That's all there is to it. And I don't think we should be squeamish about this.
Well, we've always said that if we instituted E-Verify and cut off any type of welfare benefit to illegals, then basically the self-deportation happens. And
That's right. I think that E-Verify is the real answer here. It wouldn't be necessary to formally deport people. The idea that we're going to deport 11 million people, that sounds impossible, but we don't have to deport them. We simply have to say you can't make any money now because you can't get a legal job, and you have to leave.
But in the Democrats' latest iteration of their bill, they're trying to create all sorts of welfare benefits for illegal aliens and medical care and all these kinds of things. So really, what's your incentive to leave is zero?
Yes, but not but you still have a job. I mean, the benefits to me are less crucial than the fact that people are allowed to find a job now.
Well, there's
and
that.
Employers are allowed to hire illegal people, people whom they know are illegal, but they don't have to really prove that they're illegal or legal. And under E-Verify, they would have to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we should do. I think it's pretty simple. The reason we haven't done it is because business is opposed. Some businesses, and especially agriculture, find it highly convenient to be able to hire illegal workers.
Except that's like 4% of the illegal community.
Yeah.
And we did pass legislation, I want to say 2 years ago, that, what was it, the Modernization Act. Farm Worker Modernization Act, and that did require that employers use E-Verify. The idea was, hey, if we can get this implemented in the agricultural community, then maybe we can.
Yeah, I don't recall if that went through. That would have been a huge change and a very favorable change. I mean, there is a need for farm labor. That is true. And there are some businesses where you simply can't get citizens to do the job. And we have to recognize that they're going to have to bring in some Mexicans to do that or people from Latin America. But we can still keep control of it. And we shouldn't make a gigantic hole in the system which allows people to come in any number without any real authorization. That we really have to stop that. And this is something that I think the Trump administration did correctly. You can quarrel about certain things they did as legal or bending the rules in various ways. No doubt that's true. But the fact is they cut the inflow substantially, and that was necessary, and we have to do that. I mean, I would also change the rules for legal immigration so that it wouldn't be possible to bring in so many other family members to join people that are already here. Because as it is now, every legal entry is allowed to bring in a lot of other people. So, in fact, you don't really have control. So we should limit that as well. And there are other limits we ought to make. There's a lot of problems with the immigration system.
Well, just based on your article, I think I kind of already know the answer, but when we are modeling for people who are coming to this country, whether they're coming through the program in Afghanistan or they're sneaking across the southern border, when we model for them that we really don't, give a crap about our own laws and we're not really following them,
I don't think that we give that impression in general. Once you're in the country, legally or illegally, you face the local law enforcement apparatus, which is certainly not easygoing.
Right. But don't you think that's probably kind of surprising for them?
Yep. I think that's true. And especially you can't bribe the police. You try to bribe the police, you are in serious trouble. And the police will generally refuse bribes, and you will be indicted for a serious offense. That is not allowed. The idea that you can't bribe your way out of problems with the authorities is really fundamental to the whole idea of the rule of law, and it's generally obeyed. And the place where the rule of law is really broken down is at the border. That's where the rules are so complicated that everyone thinks they can cross the border illegally and then regularize their situation later. The idea is that there are so many different statuses that you can get into once you're here that you're never really going to be deported. And that is the attitude that I think Democrats have promoted. And that has to end. We have to simplify the system. It has to be crystal clear that you have to satisfy the rules, and you have to do so before you come here. You can't cross the border illegally and then regularize your situation later. If you cross the border illegally, you should be deported immediately with no further discussion.
Why do you think that seems so unreasonable to people that that's what I'm really surprised that so many people disagree with that they can come over, and it's really not that important that they assimilate to our culture.
Well, I think the reason that drives that is essentially the moral priority of helping unfortunate people, which I mentioned before. And the impact of that is very strong. So we have all these advocate groups that want everything to be made possible for immigrants, who say truly that these people are miserable, that they're in a terrible situation, and we ought to help them out. Yes, that's true.
That is true.
And in principle, that's accurate. But we can't do it on the current scale. See, in the Bible, you never have numbers like that. You never have a society where the people who want to come in are larger in number than the people already there. I mean, there's one estimate, I think it's in that article or another one that I've written, showing that something like 700 million people in the world want to escape somehow to the Western world. And that's larger than, that's more than twice the population of the United States.
Yeah, you fundamentally changed our culture at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, we can't deal with numbers like that, and it's not morally reasonable to expect that. And so the moral discussion of immigration is entirely one-sided. It's all in favor of more. And there are all these groups that favor additional immigration. What they're not focusing on at all, we're not focusing on, is the need to maintain our basic culture, which is individualist. The people coming in now are all coming from non-individualist parts of the world, where life's about survival, where you don't take initiative, where you don't have a personal project, where you try to get through the day or the week, and that's all you want, because that's better than where you came from.
Yeah.
And that is indeed better than where you came from.
Well, I think that's a huge point, and I hope people will go and read your article. We are out of time, believe it or not.
That flew by. Thank you very much for coming
on.
Some great information there.
Thanks a million. Our guest
has been... thank you very much, and good luck, and maybe we'll talk again.
I'm sure we will. Our guest was Lawrence Mead, and we will link his other show when I find it. You can find it at wethepeopleradio.us.
By barbed wire fence, MTV on the RCA, no AC in the vents. We were Jesus, Sammy, blue jean baby, born in the USA. Trailer park, truck stop, faded little map dots, New York to L.A. We were teenage dreaming, front seat leaning, baby, come give me a kiss. Put me on the cover of the Rolling Stone, uptown, down home, American kids.